5 weeks ago, Melbourne was in festival mood. The mainstream Melbourne International Festival was on in the concert halls and theatres as well as the streets, while a fringe festival was in every other possible venue.
And the next award is for the best solo show, which, incidentally, I would have been a hot contender for. I say that with all modesty. I would have been a hot contender had the rest of the Live Wire team...
ABC Radio was there too, sponsoring Fringe Festival awards, two of which went to a play called Walking on Sticks, performed by Sarah Cathcart and directed by Andrea Lemon.
But still, I didn't win it. And here to tell us who exactly did is theatre critic and drama lecturer for the Best New Solo Show, Geoffrey Milne.
The show is to go on tour, so here's a preview and a report about the play, its making, and the vision of theatre out of which it was born.
And out it comes. Oh, surprise, surprise. The award for the best solo work seen in the Melbourne Fringe 1991 is Walking on Sticks.
Hooray by Sarah Cathcart. Fantastic.
So, Sarah Cathcart winning the best solo performance, solo show award. And this time...
I'm Sarah Cathcart and I grew up in Melbourne. I went to Lauriston Girls' School and then I went immediately to Melbourne University where I majored in English and Politics. I was there for 4 years. Then immediately after that I went to the Victorian College of the Arts and did 3 years acting. Then after that I went down to Geelong where I stayed for 4 years working with the Mill Theatre Company. After those 4 years I pursued theatre on my own and received funding from the government to create a one-person show, The Serpent's Fall, and then after that I created another one called Walking on Sticks.
You learn certain rules when living in the war zone. You don't drive over anything, a rock or a paper bag. You don't slow down or stop at bridges. And when you are walking in an area where you know that the enemy is present, you don't talk or laugh. And you avoid coughing, sneezing, and walking on sticks.
That's Frances the Nun, who's one of four characters in the play. The others being Doris, a US military woman, Doña Maria, a Nicaraguan mother, and myself, I play the tourist. And the play is about women in dangerous situations, women that I met in New York and in Nicaragua, both living in war zones, in their respective war zones. The play is a celebration of their resilience.
Why exactly did you give it to Sarah? I mean, obviously that it was fabulous.
I just thought it was a fantastic solo performance. She differentiates the four different characters splendidly.
How does she do that?
Well, with no help whatever from costumes, makeup, or anything of that kind. It's all what I think we call body language. She changes vocally
very
nicely.
Trina Parker's about to kill you, I think.
Right.
The costume designer.
But what I mean, Trina, is that she only wears the... She doesn't change costume from character to character, does she?
I only really decided to become an artist at the end of my university career. When I went to university, I found it so overwhelming and so huge that I went and joined the drama club so I could meet people. And I was never particularly good at acting. All my friends would come along and Mum and Dad would come along and there'd always be this awkward silence afterwards where it was really, well, yeah, good, good, fair, good. And then I went to drama school where I continued to struggle. At the end of that training, I was asked whether I really did want to be an actor. And I couldn't really answer it. And looking back, I now understand why that happened. I don't perform well in other people's plays or taking on characters that I'm not particularly interested in. I don't like to act just for acting's sake. There are a lot of actors who need to act. It's in their blood, it's in their chemistry, they need to act. And often those kind of actors make very good actors. But I realise now that how I wanted to pursue theatre was by investigating my own vision, that I realised that I had something very strong to say, and that when I am saying that, I perform well. My acting comes into its own.
Good morning, soldiers, and welcome to your first day of military training. My name is Sergeant Doris Nelson, and I will be your drill sergeant for the next 8 weeks. Obedience is number one, because when you are on the battlefield, split-second decisions may save a lot of people's lives. So we need soldiers to react, respond, not think, not question. We cannot have teamwork with a bunch of free thinkers.
Is there something about your own background, your own family culture, that's led you to the particular understanding of your vocation in theatre?
I think that most particularly it has to do with sitting around the dinner table with my family and me telling stories. My brothers would say, "That's a great story. That's really good. You should be in theatre." And I'd say, "Oh, no. I don't want to be an actor." But they bullied me into it because they said that I had an ability to see the world and articulate it in a way for them to see it in a new way. Somehow I could crystallise a moment or a gesture of people that we knew, relatives. I realised that it was probably one of the things I did best, so I decided to make a career of it. It was a very slow path. I think also politically, as a child, I was educated by going to England when I was 14 and going to a working class school in Oxford. And I learned on an immediate level that people don't always choose their lives, that circumstances can shape their lives. Because I went to Lauriston Girls' School, which is a very privileged school here in Melbourne, and I guess I feel that I would like to create theatre that challenges the way the world is and poses the question that it can be different. The very first feeling that I had something to say was actually at drama school when I went up to Queensland on a project to tour Aboriginal missions. And there were two Aboriginal men in my year, and they wanted to take a group of people from Victoria up to Queensland, where they came from, to show us their families and their life. And when I was there, I was first of all totally shocked at the conditions that the Aboriginal people were living in. It was like a third world country. It's the sort of stuff that you see on the television. We met an Aboriginal elder, and he took us to a sacred beach and told us all these stories. And he said, "I'm telling you these stories so you will go back to Melbourne and tell the people in Melbourne what it's like here. Tell the words that I'm teaching you. Tell the story of this beach. White people need to know our story, and you can do that because I'm telling you this story." So I went back down to Melbourne and I created a short piece of theatre for my class about that experience. And I performed it, and it was only about 2 minutes long. And that was the best way I knew to tell my classmates what it was like up there. And that was really the beginning of finding my feet as a performer and as a theatre person. So that's actually what I do now in my work. I tell other people's stories. They're people that I have met who have influenced me and changed me, changed the way I see the world. I take those stories, put it into a theatrical form, and then offer that to the audience. My guide, I guess, is myself. What sort of things don't I know about? And then I will trust that maybe the audience don't know that either. In the beginning, I worked with James McCackie. James would say, "Okay, everyone go out into Geelong and observe a leisure activity, that's going on. Observe three language events that you hear and three gestures. So I went out and I went to the bowls club down the road and I observed all these old people performing a very beautiful action. And I listened to what they said, you know, too much green or wick, wick, wobble, wobble, all this kind of generic language. And then I would hear them talk to each other about operations and cups of tea. So I take those kinds of events with maybe a limp, maybe a graceful way of bowling the ball, and a tugging of the ear as someone tries to work out which ball is closest to the kitty. And then I place these six ingredients together to create maybe a minute, 2 minutes of work. And then I took that piece of work back to the bowling club on their award night. I was extremely nervous, but the audience were absolutely delighted to see something that they just take for granted every day, created into this piece of art. And that's what James was investigating with us. It was a celebration of life around us. It was an affirmation of the people in Geelong. And this has formed the groundwork for my own work, which is looking at everyday life and realising that there's a story to be told in the thing that's staring us in the face, for instance, the bowling green down the road.
Managua, Nicaragua is a beautiful town. You buy a hacienda.
I'm travelling in a small white Russian car that doesn't have a floor. And I'm driving into Managua, Nicaragua. I've come down here on a holiday to see my best friend. She's driving. But for some reason, she isn't talking to me. She's rather speaking in Spanish to her friend, who, it turns out, is a Salvadorian gorilla in hiding in Managua. I take up smoking. Short, fat cigarettes made in Guatemala. Spanish cigars have got nothing on these. I look out the window and all I can see is miles of rubble with weeds growing out of it. Hey Anna, where's the city? She says that this is the city, that it fell down in an earthquake in 72 and it's never been rebuilt. Why not?
So how did you end up in Nicaragua? Did the idea for the play come first or did Nicaragua come first?
Well, my friend Penny O'Donnell went and lived there. And she stayed over there for 3 years. She came home in the middle of it, and we went away for the weekend, and she told me about Nicaragua. I wanted to know about the everyday life, like what did you eat, what sort of shoes do people wear, what does it look like, all that kind of stuff. And she said that Nicaragua is so chaotic politically and environmentally and economically that people like to have some kind of control over their lives. So she noticed that the young women students did things like clean their shoes and redo their makeup. She said that it was some kind of need for order. And that kind of detail just, well, fascinated me. I began to see Nicaragua in a new way. When you're here in Australia and you read about something like Nicaragua in the newspaper, it's just removed. And also the country has been mythologized. I wanted to go and visit it and see it for myself. So Penny, with those stories, triggered that interest. I was quite culture shocked at first. For 2 weeks, extremely culture shocked to the point where I had to keep lying down.
Tortilla. Tortilla.
There's a small boy shouting tortilla through my bedroom window. And it's 5:30 in the morning. No, gracias, no, it's 5:30 in the morning.
La prensa, la barricada, la semana.
Now there's a man selling newspapers. No, gracias, no.
La verduras, las frutas.
Now there's a man selling fruit, vegetables, and a woman with milk. There's a scene from Oliver going on out here.
I kept a very detailed diary and I also interviewed lots and lots of people. Lots of people. It was almost a year by the time I came back to regenerate this material. So what I did was I sat down and I would read the diaries and I would listen to the tapes and I would imagine myself back there. And as an actor, we have to develop imagination. That is our main tool. The other thing that I do is I absorb people's walks and gestures. I perform the woman who lived over the road, who was a mother who had lived through the military dictatorship and the insurrection and the revolution. And she told me all kinds of stories about her activities during the insurrection. So I absorbed her walk and her gestures, so I recreated that for myself. And I also brought back a rocking chair, and I spent a lot of time in rocking chairs doing these interviews, so I would sit in the rocking chair. And the characters did come back. Quite surprising how it works.
Para hacer una tortilla, lavo el maíz.
The smiley lady next door is teaching me how to make a tortilla. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Meta el maíz en el molino. She's been doing this at 3 o'clock in the morning for the last 22 years. Muela el maíz. Doña Maria is a campesina. She comes from the country. But she came to Managua when she was 16. She had to leave school when she was 8 because her grandmother couldn't afford to buy her a pencil. She has a husband, Jorge, who spends his life sitting in a rocking chair watching the television, whether it's on or off. She's got a son, Carlos, who works full-time for the Sandinista government. She's got a daughter, Lesti, who's 14, who's having it off with Douglas, the boy over the road. But Doña Maria doesn't know that. She had another son, Enrique, but she lost him 10 years ago in the struggle. Una tortilla. She'll get the equivalent of 2 cents for that. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Una tortilla. I have lived in this house for 22 years. And in that time, I have lived through an earthquake, a hurricane, a military dictatorship, an insurrection, a revolution, a war, threats of a Yankee invasion, an economic embargo, and a terrible headache. One thing in life that never changes is getting up at 3 a.m. to make the tortillas. 10 years ago, when we were fighting the military dictatorship of President Somoza, the tortilla was our secret weapon.
We break all the walls. Come, help me. Help us.
And you want to get rid of Somoza?
No, kill him.
Kill him?
Kill him.
Yeah.
Ay, mujer, ya no estés triste. Mire el cielo. Está limpio como el blanco de tu manita de tu ropa.
In making a play about Nicaragua, you're dealing in some ways with political romance, a political romance of the past. How did you deal with that difficulty, with the fact that you might end up with stock characters, for example, with caricature?
Well, with The Serpent's Fall and with this piece, Walking on Sticks, I do pick popular figures like the nun, the soldier, the mother with the missing son photograph. They could be made into clichés. So I avoid having a cliché by basing the characters on actual people. So when I speak to the Nicaraguan mother, she tells me stories that I wouldn't have guessed, that I couldn't have made up. And that when you are performing from the horse's mouth, it always twists your idea of what the character is. So I think that's the nature of the work I do. I never actually make anything up. I always say what they actually said to me.
Duerme, niño, duerme, amor, duerma, sientes que me duerma.
I decided on the mother because there are so many mothers in Nicaragua like her. people have said that the mothers won the war because they did do a lot of smuggling of the bombs and bullets between the suburbs and created safe houses for the fighters and took incredible risks. And she's also like an archetype, like the Latin American mother. We have that image of the mothers demonstrating with the photos of the missing children. I chose the US Army woman because I've always been interested in why women join the army and also why women join the police force and how women cope with such a male structure. Also because women in the US Army are taking more and more active roles. We're seeing them come into combat. And also the US military plays such a huge role in imperialism. And I chose the nun because I've always been fascinated by nuns. Like, how do they see the world? What do they think? What do they do in their spare time? We all have an incredible kind of fixed idea of what a nun is. So I love to, well, explode that myth. Nuns are also, I guess, an archetype in Latin America. Nuns work in war zones down there. We read about them in the news. So I spoke to four or five nuns who'd worked in the war zone in Nicaragua and created a character from those interviews. I also wanted to have a US civilian who was someone that we would like, because it's too easy to slag off at the United States, especially when you're dealing with something like Nicaragua. And having been to the United States, I've met a lot of really extraordinary people. So that was another reason why I chose the nun.
When I was a child, I didn't see nuns as happy people. Don't look back. That's what they said when we first entered the convent. I was 18. Keep yourself focused, in silence, on guard. 6 months of boot camp, as we called it, was designed to break our will, destroy our sense of self, and cut us off from the outside world. And it succeeded. The first law of the convent was obedience. But Sister Joseph had an advantage over the military because she spoke for God. Sister Joseph, may I ask forgiveness for speaking on the stairs, looking in the mirror, ripping my habit? The habit was made of 14 yards of heavy, black, synthetic material. My head was shaved, and the headpiece was held together with 14 pins. This was 1963. There were no radios, no television, no newspapers. Just poverty, chastity, and obedience. If we knew that we'd end up running around in the war zone, wearing shorts and hitchhiking, we would never have joined. Praise be Jesus Christ.
I learned a lot from meeting the Maronol nuns in the United States because they seem to have married their political selves with their religious selves, their spiritual self. And it was a great kind of learning for me to experience that. They were not women who went into Latin America to convert people because everyone's Catholic anyway, and that's not their interest. That they had a passion about life and that people had a right to a life of dignity. And they used Christ as that role model, that he was not part of the status quo, that he was on the side of the poor, and that he had a tremendous sense of community. And they locked in on that moment, on that aspect of Christ, and really lived that to the full. I'd never really met a religious person like that. I mean, I don't know very many professional religious people, but these women were extraordinary. They were brave, they were intelligent. They lived out their beliefs, which is incredibly challenging.
I have lived in this house for 22 years. One thing in life that never changes is getting up at 3 in the morning to make the tortillas.
Cristo, Cristo Jesús, identifícate con nosotros. Señor, Señor mi Dios, identifícate con nosotros. Cristo, Cristo Jesús,
solidarízate. No con la clase opresora que exprime y devora la comunidad, sino con el
oprimido. With Doña María, she had an incredible faith in God. She says in the play, it is God inside of me who makes me continue to struggle, and that a lot of the Nicaraguan people that I met did have this incredible sense of God being within, that God wasn't without. And that's not something that I was educated with when I went to Sunday school or church, that God is within. If I listen, yes, there is that thing of ask Jesus into your heart, but I never really knew what that meant, and there was never any sense that God was a great thing within. God was always something outer and authoritative. So meeting Doña María, there was this sense of that she believed that God gave her a tremendous amount of support and the courage to do something like say, yes, my house is a safe house for all the street fighters to come in and hide in order to fight the military dictatorship. I mean, that was also a confronting thing, that a woman like that, and so many women in the street did that, really put their lives at risk. Incredible risk. That they risked being imprisoned and tortured and killed.
Yeah, but have, just really paint a horrible picture for yourself so that the yuck falls down.
Yeah, right.
Okay. Soon the house is full of kids, dogs, boys, Doña María, and even the noisy neighbours.
You work in conjunction with a director. Can you explain the relationship between yourself and Andrea?
What I do with Andrea is, with both The Serpent's Fall and Walking on Sticks, I went to her and said, I have an idea for a play. This is the idea. And then she goes, oh, good. I say, oh, I'm going to research it. Then I come back and I have like a mountain of material. I mean, I spent a year researching Walking on Sticks, so there's a huge amount of material. And usually Andrea doesn't know a lot about the subject that I've been investigating. So we begin by me passing on the material, telling stories, becoming the different characters, and trying to find the centre, the through line of the piece in this way. Then we go into the rehearsal room and we still have this mountain of information, and Andrea begins to edit and shape the material. So she is like a dramaturg. She creates the shape. And the last stage is that she directs me. She fine-tunes the characters. So it's quite an unusual relationship because, in this case, the actor has the vision and the idea and the director realises it for the actor, when usually it's the other way around. And we actually have a fantastic working relationship, and she's a fantastic, brilliant dramaturg and a wonderful director. We have great fun in the rehearsal room, and from my experience, when you have great fun, good work happens.
How does that work now? The beginning, you've got to go further with the beginning, so it's sort of like it really starts with that sense of the nine-year-old, the born nine-year-old. Mm. And so by the end of the scene, you've actually been educated.
Yeah, that's good.
And by the end of the scene, the reality has finally dropped in.
You've just sold it to me, Andrea.
Good.
Andrea Lemon, co-writer and director of Walking on Sticks.
The piece itself, Walking on Sticks, is extremely dense. There is an enormous amount of information, and because Sarah is the only actor in the piece and she's playing the four different characters, it's very complex for an audience to watch. It means that the audience is also having to work. You know, it's not a piece for a complacent audience by any stretch of the imagination. And so by the time you get to the third act, there are four different character through lines, stories that we have to bring to an end. There's about three or four different very strong issues that we're having to finalise and resolve and bring them all together also theatrically so that we have a sense by the end of the play of satisfaction so that it all makes sense.
What are you looking at?
I met Doris in New York on the Lower East Side, where the streets are a little too dark and a little too deserted. So I went into a bar, which was a little too dark and a little too deserted. The bar was long.
The original draft of the play actually had the first half in Nicaragua and the second half in New York, so there was a lot more information and stories from New York in there. But when we actually looked at it and put it together, we realised that, in fact, what the play is talking about is the notion of the enemy and using Nicaragua and North America as the canvas for that, and that by focusing too much on New York, it actually seemed to take the weight and the strength away from the Nicaraguan stories. So we decided to actually pull most of that stuff out and use what stories we needed to with the Doris character, who's the US soldier, to simply use those stories and Sarah's experiences, which reflected enough information for us.
There were some days when I loved being a soldier. It was a challenge, and I love a challenge.
I did actually want to play a man, but
just for something to do on a Sunday afternoon.
But he didn't make it. That was the stockbroker. And I think that in the end, Andrea and I feel that we know more about women, and that we wanted to talk about these women's lives.
And the piece is actually talking a lot about male perspective from a female point of view. It's about war, it's about the church, it's about the army, the revolution even, that they're all, in a sense, male hierarchies that these women are having to survive in, and the play is looking at how they do that. And so the idea of having the stockbroker becomes too obvious, in a sense, that, you know, that, yeah, what we're talking about is money when we're talking about conflict.
It was amazing, too, when I was interviewing the stockbrokers, they felt like clichés. You know, yeah. I just want to make money, you know. Why else would I be a stockbroker?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not like...
It's dog-eat-dog, and you just want to piss on them, and it's all this sort of stuff.
Like kind of language.
Out. Yeah, you know.
And Andrew said, this just feels like a cliché, and I said, well, I'm sorry, that's what they said to me.
I fell in love with Frances. I think she's my favourite character. I think she's fantastic. You know, I got halfway through rehearsals and decided I wanted to join the nunnery. I wanted to kind of go out and discover that sense of community. I think Frances also is the character who thinks the most deeply about things, well, who, I guess, is in a position to develop a philosophy, whereas Doña Maria and Doris are both experiential characters. They're in the middle of their experiences. So they're actually living it now, whereas Frances is, because of her training and because of her job and because of her situation as a North American in Nicaragua, is in a position to reflect.
I was in the plaza the day the Pope came to Nicaragua. Thousands of people came from all over the country to see him. They brought some mothers up to the front to ask the Pope if he would say a prayer for their sons, who had been killed a few days before by the Contra. And the Pope refused. Then the mothers asked him again. But the Pope continued to ignore their pleas. And the people became very angry and they began to shout at the Pope. And I thought, what am I doing in a church that is so frightened of losing its authority? A church that has an image of God ruling over us, ruling over the earth. That only justifies people having power over others. I came very close to leaving the church, but I have decided to stay. You can't always change things by leaving.
What is this fascination with nuns?
I think it's actually a fascination, it's a combination of the return to a fascination with some sort of spiritual belief. And, you know, that can be Christian beliefs, it could be Eastern beliefs, it could be different kind of, you know, New Age beliefs. That people are searching for something other again. And that feminism has been around for a long time, and so people have been starting to review women's roles in different kind of traditional situations in our society. And so the two of them have come together, that people are sort of kind of looking at nuns who have been the forgotten part of our society, in a sense, and starting to say, right, well, what do they actually have to offer? Why have they made those choices? And they are fascinating, especially, I think, since the 60s. They are very political women.
Have you actually ever met any?
Briefly in passing.
Thank you.
I'm sitting on a 5-inch wide plank on an extremely slow-moving barge, and I'm heading towards the Mosquito Coast. I'm scanning the banks for Contra. The barge is full of mothers and babies. Well, they don't seem to be very worried. Sarah, don't worry. Don't think about it. Francis wouldn't have asked you if it was dangerous. I move to the front of the barge, and I'm still scanning the banks. I don't feel good. I don't feel relaxed. I'd make a terrible war correspondent. I feel the captain by my side. He's checking some cargo. Have you ever seen any Contra around here?
I wouldn't worry about them.
Well, they have attacked the boats, haven't they?
They won't attack us.
How do you know?
Because I am a Contra.
Pardon?
If they weren't here, this country would be completely communist. Why don't you chelas go home? You don't know what is going on here. In Somoza's time, we could buy 2 or 3 cars. Now we can't buy sugar. The Nicaraguan revolution is so famous, all the world wants to come and look. But this revolution keeps us poor. I tell you, when the United States finally bombs this country to get rid of this revolution, all you internationalistas will get a ticket out of here. And we don't even want the Sandinistas.
The way to avoid didacticism is to make sure that you reflect all parties involved, and that if we're talking about struggles and enemies and conflicts over borders, then you have at least 2, 3, 4, 10 different points of view. So there is Contra Captain. It's important for us to also hear his perspective. Why people didn't like the Sandinista government.
They brought in a truckload of young Contra boys. All dead. And everyone was so excited. They were climbing all over the truck to look. It was horrifying. But these were all just young Nicaraguan boys who had probably been kidnapped by the Contra in the first place. They should not have been fighting any more than our boys should. But they were the enemy. And we have come to see them as somehow less than human.
The fact that it is now historical, I think, actually works very well for us. Because, in fact, although ostensibly the piece is about Nicaragua and North America, the initial impetus to create it was not about that. It was about the notion of conflict and the notion of the personal desire and the political desire for an enemy to clarify our lives in some way. It makes no difference, really, what we say about them at this stage. It is reflection.
Yes, I was changed by going to Nicaragua, significantly changed, and that's exactly why I went there. I went there not to make a piece of theatre. I went there to be confronted and challenged about the ways of the world.
Someone said to me after the play that they wished it integrated in some way how you've changed.
Well, actually, that's a really interesting question. I think that the impact is making the play and presenting myself in the play as a naive person, and then the audience seeing that it is me portraying these other women and hearing what they say, that if the audience go the step further, they can think, oh, well, she's the actor, she has taken on board all the things that those women are saying. And to spell it out in the play would have been too much. Too literal, yeah.
Well, I found it really inspiring. I had to fight back the tears a few times. I can only say I think that sounds terrible and sexist, but I really only think a woman could do that.
It's a different way of doing it rather than what you see from the church where you preach about justice and all, but this is really acted out with a lot of human voice coming out through it. I think that was very powerful.
I come from the Philippines, so Doña Maria really spoke to me. I mean, I felt personally in some of the characters there. As I said, especially this mother who, with a missing son.
Terribly enthralling, inspiring. I wanted to laugh, I wanted to cry, I wanted to shout.
And yet I felt that it wasn't just a spectacle for me to enjoy. It was something that, you know, went deep into me that I must grapple with.
If you'd like more information about where Walking on Sticks is to be performed, contact me, Margaret Coffey, at the ABC GPO Box 994, Melbourne 3001. Thank you to Sarah Cathcart, Andrea Lemon, and the staff and students of Yarra Theological Union. Technical production was by Neil Hobbs.
Managua, Nicaragua is a beautiful town. You buy a hacienda for a few pesos down. You give it to the lady you are trying to win, but her papa doesn't let you come in. Managua, Nicaragua is a heavenly place. You ask a senorita for a little embrace. She answers you, caramba, scrampa, pamperito. In Managua, Nicaragua, that's no.
I have been to many tropic ports. I might include even Brooklyn. If you're ever feeling out of sorts, I'd like to recommend a look
in Managua, Nicaragua, what a wonderful spot. There's coffee and bananas and the temperature hot. So take a trip and on a ship go sailing away across the aqua to Managua, Nicaragua, ole. And bananas and the temperature hot. So take a trip and on a ship go sailing away across the aqua to Managua, Nicaragua. Olé!